Cantor's defeat means no one is safe. The price of a gram goes up in South Carolina. And President Obama disagrees with Senator Obama. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 31 of The Political Junkie. And wow, Eric Cantor? I'm still reeling about that one. What message does his defeat send to Republicans who want to work with Democrats? What's next for the leadership of the House GOP? And what does it mean for the future of immigration legislation? So much to talk about, and believe me, we will. Plus, Barack Obama says it's an abuse of power for a president to go around laws passed by Congress, unless he does it. Lindsey Graham takes on the Tea Party in South Carolina and lives to tell the tale. Hillary Clinton has a book in which, shockingly, nothing is controversial. And speaking of 2016, we take a snapshot of Iowa some 19 months before the caucuses. Why not? Finally, this week in political history brings us back to the time when Bob Dole left his beloved Senate to focus on his plan for winning the White House. But first, the trivia question. Hillary Clinton, as you know, launched her book tour this week in what most people expect will be another step on the road to a second presidential campaign. Needless to say, if she ran and won, she would be the first spouse of a former president to become president. But who was the first presidential wife to run for any kind of office? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget, you don't have to wait until Thursday to hear the trivia question. Head over to our Political Junkie Facebook page for a sneak peek every Wednesday afternoon. We'll give you the answer to last week's question later in the show. We weren't planning to lead the show with Tuesday's primary results, but yikes. I think I just stared at the TV for hours on Tuesday night. I couldn't understand what I was seeing. Eric Cantor, with $5 million in the bank, the powerful House Majority Leader from Virginia's 7th Congressional District, perhaps a future Speaker of the House, he loses his primary to a Tea Party challenger named David Bratt, a college professor nobody has ever heard of. Bratt spent maybe $100,000, maybe $200,000 on his campaign, tops. Cantor, who many thought was on better terms with conservatives than Speaker John Boehner, suddenly became the guy who was soft on immigration. According to the Bratt campaign, he supported amnesty. He was for open borders. Bratt used these talking points over and over and over, and conservative talk radio hosts repeated it over and over and over. And with almost no warning, Cantor lost, becoming the first House Majority Leader in history to be defeated for renomination in a primary. This wasn't even on my radar. Greg Giroux is one of the smartest guys I know about politics. He's a reporter with Bloomberg News. For years before that, at Congressional Quarterly. Greg, please don't tell me you saw this coming.
I did not see this coming. As much as I like to study political history and try and prepare for every contingency, I was completely blindsided by the result.
No, but not on your radar screen. I mean, we knew that there was some dissatisfaction with Eric Cantor with some Tea Party folks, but not enough to defeat him.
Yeah, I thought there would be a sizable protest vote against Cantor, but I didn't expect that David Bratt would win the race outright, much less win it by double digits over the sitting House Majority Leader.
How did this happen? I mean, what was the roots of this problem, the dissatisfaction?
Well, I think it was very under the radar, very subterranean. I think Cantor's difficulties owe to a lot of factors, and the trick is how much weight do you assign to any one of those factors. There was a lot of kind of local Tea Party energy, a lot of dissatisfaction with quote-unquote Washington politicians. We see from polling data that there is kind of an a very palpable anti-Washington sentiment, I should say, out there. And Cantor's district, which is, you know, 50 to 100 miles away from the nation's capital, there are a lot of conservative Tea Party activists who are very disappointed with the direction of Washington. And Eric Cantor, being the number two House Republican, sort of personified Washington, if you will. And I think they really took it out on him. There was, I think, some local political issues at stake there. And Eric Cantor actually went negative on his opponent, Dave Bratt, airing a couple of television commercials, attacking him as a liberal economics professor. And from people I've talked to in the district, that actually could have backfired and maybe generated some sympathy among Tea Party activists who kind of suspect of Cantor.
If you were dissatisfied with the way that things were going in Congress and with the Republican leadership of Congress, then you defeat Mitch McConnell, you defeat John Boehner. That didn't come close to happening. And that was actually a lot of focus was on those two because you knew that they were front and center, the representatives, representation of the Republican leadership in Congress. And Eric Cantor, as you say, under the radar, and he's the one who loses.
That's right. It's very stunning. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. I think maybe one difference between Cantor's situation and some other Republican incumbents, including McConnell, is that from what I've learned about the race in the 7th district where Cantor lost, is that he may not have done the kind of political spade work that, you know, every member of Congress has to do. Regardless of your title, you're the Speaker, Majority Leader, Minority Leader, you still are the representative of that congressional district of that state, and you still have to do the constituent services. You have to be a visible presence in the district, showing up at the rallies, at the parades. And I think Eric Cantor's leadership, national leadership position, took him outside the district quite a bit. That's an encumbrance that a lot of other incumbents don't have.
There was a lot of analysis on Tuesday night saying that this was really about the immigration issue, that David Bratt talked about Eric Cantor was for amnesty, that he was for open borders, that he was, you know, violating Republican principles. How big was the immigration issue in the result?
I think it's fair to say it was a contributing factor, but I don't think it was the dominant factor. I think there were a lot of factors at work here. It is clear that Eric Cantor was getting whipsawed on the immigration issue. You had people on the right, the Tea Party right, David Bratt, saying that the majority leader supported, quote, amnesty. But then you had a visible active presence of some progressive or liberal activists pushing Cantor to bring the Senate, a Senate-passed immigration overhaul, to the House floor. So he was taking flack from both sides. But I think there were a lot of other factors at work. But I think it's fair to say immigration was one of them.
On Wednesday, Cantor announced he would resign at the end of July as majority leader, and he backed Kevin McCarthy, his whip, to take his place. But that may not be enough for the Tea Party.
It may not be. And Kevin McCarthy won't get that position uncontested. Leadership election is coming up in about a week. And it's also going to be an interim position in that it's just really to fill the majority leader's position for the rest of this congressional session. We'll have to do this all over again. They could have, you know, new leadership elections at the beginning of 2015 after the November elections. McCarthy wants to be majority leader. Eric Cantor said that he would support him. But there are other people looking at that number two spot. Jeb Hensarling, congressman from Texas, who leads the Financial Services Committee, is one of them.
We heard a lot of anger from conservative rank-and-file grassroots people last couple of days talking about the dissatisfaction with Congress and the leadership. And yet, Cantor's only the second House member to lose in the primary this year, Ralph Hall of Texas, who was 91 years old, so there may have been other factors in Hall losing. But if there's so much dissatisfaction out there, and I suspect there is, why are not more incumbents paying for it?
Well, a lot of them haven't been seriously challenged. A lot of them are actually doing the kind of district-specific political work they need to do to ward off challenges. They're not encumbered by, you know, a very close attachment, I think, to the Republican leadership that I think may have hurt Cantor in this race. And we've all, as you mentioned, there have only been two House members, Hall and Cantor, who have been denied renomination thus far, and we're already past more than half of the primary so far. So while we see this kind of anti-Washington sentiment and, you know, even the percentage of people saying they would vote to reelect their own member of Congress is historically low, we still don't have, no confidence elections. You have to run somebody against somebody. And in many of these cases, in a lot of these contrast elections, the House incumbents have just been able to parlay the advantages of incumbency and weak opposition to win renomination.
One of the people thought to be at risk in Tuesday's primary was Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina. We thought he was going to be the main story on Tuesday night, but he apparently learned the lesson that many Republicans may not have learned in 2010 and 2012. He prepared for a Tea Party primary assault. He did all the right things, and he won without having to be pulled into a runoff.
Yes, that was an outright victory for Lindsey Graham. He needed a majority of the vote. He wound up with more than 56% of the vote. And he did prepare for a Tea Party challenge. He amassed a huge campaign war chest well before he knew who his opponents would be. And I think he was aided in part by having six opponents rather than one. So many of them really struggled to get out of the box and become that lead challenger to Graham. I have to think if it was a one-on-one race, maybe some of the Tea Party aligned groups may have engaged in that race. But I believe that Graham's closest challenger didn't even break 15 or 16% of the vote. And if you look at Graham's campaign, his spending, his advertisements, I mean, he focused on his differences with the Obama administration on Benghazi. And he also focused on some state-specific issues like deepening the Port of Charleston and emphasizing how important the Port of Charleston is to the state economy.
On Tuesday night, one of the press releases I saw came from Chris McDaniel, the guy who's hoping to knock out Thad Cochran in the June 24th runoff in Mississippi. And the press release basically said, we beat him. We beat Eric Cantor. Does the David Bratt beating Eric Cantor resonate at all in the Thad Cochran runoff in Mississippi?
I'm not sure that it does. I think that it really doesn't change the dynamics of that race. I do think it probably emboldens McDaniel's supporters more than it would Cochran's, but I think we've known since the first round race in the Mississippi primary on June the 3rd that McDaniel would have the advantage in a runoff election with more energy on his side and having won a plurality of the vote but not a majority. What I did see after Tuesday's election in Virginia when Cantor lost is a lot of other little known candidates, challengers to Republican incumbents, aligning themselves with the Tea Party or trying to use the Cantor loss as, to say basically, hey, look at me out here. I'm like David Bratt. My incumbent is just like, Eric Cantor, too tied to Washington, a careerist, not listening to the grassroots. And you should come out and help my insurgent campaign as well.
Greg Giroux is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He can be found on Twitter at Greg Giroux. Greg, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Oh, by the way, Greg and I are not the only people who were stunned by what happened in Virginia on Tuesday. Here are some people who called into our Political Junkie hotline.
Ken, this is Ned James down here in Jacksonville, Florida. Even though I live in Jacksonville, I'm a longtime Virginia resident and grew up in Eric Cantor's district, and I'm absolutely stunned by his defeat tonight. I know the district quite well, just shocked. This opens up a seat for a Democrat that I thought would never be held by a Democrat.
Hi, Ken. It's John in California. I would hope that the defeat of Eric Cantor would be a wake-up call for the GOP and tell them that they really can't kowtow to those jerks in the Tea Party and that they have to really make an effort to start getting the Republican Party back toward the center, the party of the Rockefellers, the Saltonstalls of Massachusetts, the Henry Cabot Lodge, the Jake Javits, etc. So I think I would hope this would be a wake-up call. Anyway, thanks for listening.
This is the best news I've had all week. If I never have to hear that guy's snarky voice again, I'm going to be one happy woman.
This is Elliot Cubell, New York, New York. Really, the one thing I can be sure of is that this is a case of hubris, kind of like what Ted Cruz has and what knocks down a lot of politicians. Eric Cantor got bit by the hubris bug too early in his career, comparatively, but I think that's pretty much what did it.
This is Philip Gilfist from Greensboro, North Carolina. I am completely stunned about the news about Eric Cantor's defeat tonight in Virginia. Clearly, Cantor was one of the few, probably, who arguably wanted to be Speaker, but with him gone, I think this in some ways clears the field for the Speaker circle, maybe also means that Boehner has to stay for another couple of years. But I thought one of the biggest stories of this primary season, Eric Cantor being defeated, and I'm stunned right now. I almost had to make sure I had my both hands on the wheel here.
Thanks for your reactions. I love them. I appreciate it. And I share your astonishment, your stunosity. It was just never saw it coming. This was not on my radar screen at all. It was just a shocker. I should let you know, for the record, we did not have a predict the primary winners contest this week, and that probably was a mistake. But wow, would anybody have predicted this? The next primary night is in 2 weeks on June 24th. Lots of states with primaries, including the big runoff in Mississippi, a GOP race to watch in Oklahoma, Charlie Rangel's future in New York, and much more. Make sure you check out our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com, for details about the next contest. Republicans are not the only ones with problems these days. There's one Democrat in particular that's having a fair share right now. President Obama is still getting heat over the deal he made to bring back Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the American soldier who was being held by the Taliban. Was he a deserter? Did the deal empower the Taliban? But there was also a bigger question. Did the president violate the law by not consulting with Congress before the agreement to free the five Taliban commanders at Guantanamo? Critics say he did. The president says he has the right to disregard parts of laws passed by Congress he disagrees with. We brought in two experts to make sense of it all. Cy Lazarus is a senior counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center and was on President Jimmy Carter's White House domestic policy staff. Chris Edelson is an assistant professor of government at American University's School of Public Affairs. He is the author of Emergency Presidential Power, From the Drafting of the Constitution to the War on Terror. Gentlemen, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off this conversation with something Senator Barack Obama said on the campaign trail in 2008.
Congress's job is to pass legislation. The president can veto it or he can sign it. But what George Bush has been trying to do as part of his effort to accumulate more power in the presidency is he's been saying, well, I can basically change what Congress passed by attaching a letter saying, I don't agree with this part or I don't agree with that part. I'm going to choose to interpret it this way or that way. That's not part of his power. But this is part of the whole theory of George Bush that he can make laws as he's going along. I disagree with that. I taught the Constitution for 10 years. I believe in the Constitution, and I will obey the Constitution of the United States. We're not going to use signing statements as a way of doing an end run around Congress. All right?
There was Senator Obama in 2008. President Obama says, quote, unique circumstances allow him to bypass the federal statute about telling Congress about the swap. Cy Lazarus, does it?
What the president's saying is, as I understand it, and the administration, is that if they had delayed and given the 30 days notice, that it might have endangered Bergdahl's life. If that's true, and I don't know that it's true or not true, but if that's true, then I certainly believe that the administration was justified in bypassing that particular statutory deadline for a number of statutory and constitutional reasons, which I won't go into. I'd like to hear what Professor Edelson thinks about it.
So I think Cy is absolutely correct. There is a well-recognized principle that during an emergency, the president can act. The framers certainly understood that. They said Congress has the power to declare war. The president can act to repel a sudden attack. The key problem, though, is so when a president does act during an emergency, when there's no time to consult with Congress, I think the important limiting principle is going to Congress after the fact and explaining what the emergency was. The good example here to me is President Lincoln in 1861 took action with Congress out of session, gave them a message July 4th, 1861, explained why it was necessary. So I think Cy is right. If there's an emergency here, it should be explained. I'm sympathetic to that point. I hope that they will do so now.
You say there were circumstances that made it happen at that point. But as Dianne Feinstein, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said not long after that the administration has been talking about this for 2 years already. This has been in the works. Could they have not told Congress 30 days in advance that this was about to happen?
The only point that I'm really trying here to make is that the notion that there's some kind of constitutional violation involved here or even a real legal violation in the sense that we usually understand that of something that a court might enforce, I think is wrong. I think that if perhaps the administration could have gotten more quickly on the job in telling Congress about this, if Secretary Hagel says that's true, I'm certainly not going to quarrel with that. But I just think that this is a little bit of a tempest in a teapot and a matter between Congress and congressional leaders and the White House. It's a kerfuffle that needs to be resolved, but that's where it needs to be resolved, in my view.
Well, Chris, what about the argument about hypocrisy? I mean, we know what Senator Obama said in 2008. The Bergdahl circumstances may have been different, but ultimately the president feels he has the power to circumvent or bypass certain laws passed by Congress if he doesn't agree with them.
Yeah. So here's my concern, with a great deal of respect for what Cy is saying. The problem to me with the Bush administration, which President Obama rightly identified in 2008, was a disregard for the law, the idea the president was above the law. A really Nixonian idea, obviously in a different context, the war on terror instead of political opposition. But the Bush administration advocated and implemented the unitary executive theory, the idea that the president can set aside legal constraints, statutory or perhaps even constitutional constraints on action if the president decides it's necessary to do so in order to use executive power. President Obama rightly denounced those actions, including some of that was done sometimes through signing statements, sometimes in other ways. The problem to me about the Obama administration is I'm not confident they've repudiated that approach. And signing statements is one example. I'll give a few other ones. The use of military force. President Obama said in Libya, we are going to use military force even beyond the 60-day war powers resolution period because we've concluded that it simply doesn't rise to the level of hostilities. The targeted killings program, the killing most notably of Anwar al-Awlaki and his son without judicial process. The surveillance program discussed by Edward Snowden. The use of signing statements or the illusion of signing statements in the Bergdahl setting is another example of that. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'd like to see the Obama administration recognize meaningful limits on power to make clear they're not doing what the Bush administration has done.
Sorry, I'm not going to make the case that President Obama is doing exactly what President Bush did, both in numbers and reasons for these signing statements or executive actions. But do you see a little sense of...
Well, I think it's very important to be a little nuanced about this. All modern presidents have used signing statements to specify that there are provisions in laws that they passed. After all, most important laws now get passed as part of massive omnibus laws, and there's no way to veto that law, but there might be things tucked into it that a president would legitimately think is unconstitutional or infringes on his executive authorities and responsibilities. So all presidents have used signing statements to point those provisions out and say that they are going to not necessarily implement them. And that's really quite legitimate. As Chris just pointed out, Bush did something totally different. He invoked this unitary executive theory to say that whatever happens in the executive branch is my business, not Congress's business, not the court's business. And that is really saying I'm above the law. Obama has not done that and is not doing that. His opponents have used this notion that he's violating his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed primarily to do Obamacare bashing. They have taken the various delays of pieces of the Affordable Care Act as evidence of violating the law and violating his constitutional duties. And those charges are really bogus. He is not refusing to enforce the Affordable Care Act, certainly not. If he were, his opponents would be overjoyed, really. He is phasing in the Affordable Care Act and adjusting the schedule and adjusting statutory deadlines. All presidents have had to do that in phasing in laws like President Bush's prescription drug benefit revision of Medicare, major changes in healthcare laws that happened during the Clinton administration. So that's a bogus thing. I just wanted to distinguish these completely hyperventilated claims that the president is violating the Constitution with respect to his administration of the health reform law, actions with respect to immigration and so forth.
Carbon emissions
carbon emissions also. From the national security area, which Chris was speaking about in a very well-informed fashion. I think that's a deeper problem. I think that basically Congress has abdicated its constitutional responsibilities with respect to declaring war and taking responsibility for hard decisions about national security actions. And it's been doing this chronically for decades.
But when was the last time they declared war? 1942, right?
I think that's right. Right, Romania or Bulgaria.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
And so the reality is that presidents have become wildly more exclusive centers of power and decision and action on national security fronts than was originally contemplated. But it's because Congress has abdicated. That doesn't mean that everything that every president has done is legitimate and appropriate. But it does mean that as soon as you get in the White House, you realize you have responsibilities for protecting the nation's security in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan, in Syria, in Africa, and so forth. And you can't just sit there. And Congress is not really interested in taking responsibility for the decisions that have to be made. So it's a big problem, but it's a different kind of problem.
There's a balance, and he's right about this. The president has to have enough power to act, as Cy says, especially in the context of defending the nation. But there have to be limits on presidential power. Cheney's point as Ford's chief of staff was we need to make sure we defend presidential prerogative. Cheney was especially successful in this during the Bush administration, of course, but he really laid the seeds for this as a member of Congress in the 1980s when the Iran-Contra scandal occurred. He was on the minority committee that issued a report defending the Reagan administration had broken two laws, the Export-Import Act regarding Iran and the Boland Amendment regarding supporting the Contras. And the minority report said the president can do this. He has inherent power to set aside the law. A really stunning statement. Vice President Cheney later said, if you want to know what I think about presidential power, look at that minority report. And this is the unitary executive theory that Cy and I have spoken about before. It's a really dangerous idea that puts a president above the law. Cheney implemented that during the Bush administration. And Cy is right. It is important to make this – it's not just a nuance. It's an important distinction. The Obama administration has not embraced the unitary executive theory. My point, though, is just because this unitary executive theory is so dangerous, I think it is important for presidents, Obama and successors, to make clear that they recognize limits on power. And that's my concern. But of course, yes, it's not the same thing. Cy is right about that.
Chris Edelson is an assistant professor of government at American University's School of Public Affairs. Cy Lazarus is a senior counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center. Both joined us here in the studios. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. A pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Cy.
Very, very enjoyable.
After the break, we talked to Maggie Haberman of Politico about Hillary Clinton's book tour and what political junkies should look forward to during the inevitable media blitz. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Stick around. We're still some 19 months away from the Republican presidential caucuses, and of course 2016 may not be on everyone's mind just yet. There's some new polling over the last week that has some interesting findings. One being that Republicans with the highest negatives might have the best chances of beating the Democratic candidate. Ann Selzer is a pollster for the Des Moines Register. She's also president of Selzer & Company, a Des Moines public opinion research firm. And despite her requests, she's a frequent guest on The Political Junkie. Ann, thanks for being on the show again.
You're saying I need an unlisted number.
Have you moved since we last spoke last week?
No, still here.
Just the city manager. So tell us, I was looking at your poll and the numbers and everything, and Chris Christie and Jeb Bush's numbers are very interesting.
You know, I thought this was just fascinating that when we ask people, well, how do you feel about these candidates, favorable or unfavorable? The two with the highest score in the unfavorability column are Chris Christie and Jeb Bush. On the favorable side, people like Paul Ryan and they like Mike Huckabee. And they like them far better than they like Chris Christie or Jeb Bush. But when we switched the question and said, well, who do you think would have the best chance of being elected over a Democratic candidate in November of 2016, that's where Chris Christie and Jeb Bush topped the list. And what I think is helpful about this poll is that people have an idea that if it's Iowa, it must be time for an ideological purist. That has sort of led some candidates to decide to spend less time in Iowa, feeling that they just wouldn't get a very good reception. To me, this says really there's a reception to be had for a diverse field of candidates. I think we tested 12 names on the Republican list, or 11, I guess. Seven of them got into double digits within 9 points of each other. So there's a lot of acceptance for different kinds of candidates here. It's kind of y'all come.
Well, you talk about the expectation game in Iowa, and when you think of the last two Iowa caucuses, the winners were Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, who were very conservative candidates. Now, not many people
Mitt Romney won for a day or two.
That's right. I think they're still counting there. Not many people are talking nationally about Huckabee and Santorum, and yet what's the view of them in Iowa?
Well, you know, they sort of are flirting with us. And Santorum has been back to the state. I think Mike Huckabee has been here. They are certainly on the phone and talking to Republican leaders here. So that's always a sign that they are thinking it over, that they're trying to figure out where the stars are right now.
Well, Rick Santorum only won in 2012. But they almost sound like old names or old hat already, because you have these new people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. What about Ted Cruz? I mean, everywhere he goes, he gets standing ovations at state conventions around the country. How do you fare in your numbers?
Well, and he's been to Iowa a few times, but even so, he's not terribly all that well known. So 36% didn't know enough to even offer an opinion about him. So he's investing in Iowa. He's spending the time here, but not really getting traction.
Rick Perry had surprisingly high likable numbers, and yet he's basically kind of dismissed by the political elite in the country.
And Rick Perry is, again, putting in some face time here and coming around and meeting people. He had a series of unfortunate events, shall we say.
Can you name all three? I can name the first two. I can't name the third one.
Right. And I think he's in better physical shape. Our sense, when we're talking to his operatives, or I guess when they're talking to us, that he is back on the horse properly seated. And so really strongly considering another run. And he wears well. I mean, there's a self-deprecating side of him that is charming.
When is it time to start polling who the favorites are for 2016?
Well, it's when we think we can get a legitimate and reasonably defensible sample of likely caucus goers. And that's not going to be this year, and will be next year, probably 2015. As to whether we do that early in the year or later, we really need some candidates to declare that they're going to run, and then we start the clock ticking.
Well, Anne, we're definitely going to have you on the show when that happens, and really don't leave your phone because you never know when I'm going to call you again.
I look forward to it.
Anne Selzer is president of Selzer & Company and is the pollster for the Des Moines Register. Even more impressive, she's been on the program 2 weeks in a row. Anne, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Here's something that has absolutely nothing to do with 2016. Well, at least not officially. Hillary Clinton has started her national book tour to promote Hard Choices, all about her tenure as Secretary of State. Maggie Haberman is a senior political reporter for Politico and has been on the Clinton book beat. Maggie, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you were at Clinton's book signing at Barnes & Noble in New York, and you had this great tweet. I really, really enjoyed it. You put up this photo of the rules people had to follow if they want to get their book signed by the former First Lady. What were some of those rules?
Right. The rules were, there were many, but it was a lot of it was logistics about you're going to end up being on the fourth floor and you have to go through a security sweep on the second floor, one bracelet per customer, one book per customer. And then there was one line that was sort of stood out, which was she will not be personalizing the books or signing memorabilia. And then no, in all caps, photographs will be taken with her. You know, the people who I spoke to who were waiting in line were like, well, I understand she's very busy and there's lots of people here. But it was a very jarring list of rules.
I wonder, I mean, does anybody think, or did you think that because you're a political reporter, when you were thinking of those barriers between Hillary Clinton and her populace, can you envision a presidential campaign similar to that?
Well, look, we've seen this with other candidates, right? I mean, Rudy Giuliani was heavily criticized when he ran in 2008. In the primaries, you know, he would be behind a rope line at his event. That just doesn't work. I think that Hillary Clinton is not somebody who does just great in small settings. In my experience covering her, I've been covering her on and off since 99. She does not do great in big settings. When she gives big speeches, she tends to come off as flat. You know, there have been times in the last couple of months where we have seen her be much looser than we were before. She was not loose when she took the stage yesterday, and the whole setup was sort of weird. It was a giant desk. With a leather chair. It looked very sort of faux presidential. And there was literally an assembly line of people helping pass these books along. So one would open the book and then pass it on to the other person who would deliver it to her. And then she would sign on the author page. And then it would be handed to somebody else who would then, you know, crank their arm around and hand it to the person that they were leaving. You can't do that in a campaign. And so to the extent that this is sort of a mini campaign, there are a lot of differences. She's not her husband. She's not, right? I mean, she's not a touchy-feely politician. This is not what she's good at. It's not what she has ever been good at. When I could only contrast it to Elizabeth Warren's book signing, which was at the same Barnes & Noble a couple of weeks ago, and not just because of the obvious, which is Warren is seen as somebody who could be threatening to Hillary Clinton, although she has said she is not running. But her book signing was much smaller. There were about 200 people. They were all seated, and there were fewer than five reporters. I was one of them. No TV cameras at all. And we were all sitting the entire time. She did a reading. She you know, gesticulated a lot. She used her hands as she talked. She walked back and forth. She mocked herself for how much she uses her hands. And she took questions, albeit pre-screened, but she took questions from the audience. This was nothing like that.
Are you going to follow the Hillary Clinton around the country, or are you just waiting in New York for her to stop by at Barnes & Noble?
I'm kind of that sounds like a lot of waiting around. I am going to follow her down the Eastern Seaboard to Washington on Friday. She's going to be in Philadelphia before that, which I'm not going to, and then she's going to be at a Costco in Arlington, Virginia on Saturday, which I will go to.
How big was the crowd when at Barnes & Noble in New York?
So it's an interesting question. They, by the time they started letting people in, it was about maybe 250. But there were, you know, then they were letting people in much after that because a lot of people didn't line up at crazy times. They started letting them in at 9 a.m. for an 11 a.m. event. They said they were going to do a cutoff at 1,000, and I still don't have an answer as to whether actually 1,000 people showed up. My assumption is yes, but I don't know. And my assumption is yes only based on interest in her last book.
Everything I hear, every time I read a review about her book or everything she's talked about, somebody invariably will ask her, will you or won't you run? And, of course, you know, she obviously has the obligatory answer, but that can get tiresome after a while, can it?
I think it's tiresome for her, certainly for those of us waiting for a yes or a no. At the end of the day, I don't think she hasn't made up her mind. I mean, I think she could end up not running. But I think she's running, and I think that she assumes she's running, and she's certainly behaving as if she's running.
Since you're going to be on the book tour, is there a drinking game every time you hear a question about will she or won't she, you take a drink?
Oh, you know what? At 11 a.m., that feels like a very dangerous game, so not yet, but I'll keep you posted if one breaks out somewhere.
Maggie, you don't sound like a real political reporter. Maggie Haberman is a senior political reporter for Politico. She's on Twitter at Maggie Politico. Maggie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, This Week in Political History looks back at a day a Senate giant stepped down. I'm Ken Rudin, and you're listening to The Political Junkie. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Veterans Affairs Secretary who was elected to public office? Well, the last and only VA secretary to do that was its first, Ed Derwinski, an Illinois Republican who served in the House from 1959 through 1982 and who was President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Veterans Affairs from 1989 to 1992. And the winner is Jim Newman of Campden Hills, Illinois. Jim gets the political junkie button. And last week's scuttle button puzzle, there was a button for the Organic Tea Party. There was one for California Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, one that said Men for Women for McGovern Shriver, and finally a Teddy Roosevelt button with the words A Square Deal. And that leaves you with T. Anna Men Square. A cute puzzle maybe, but the scene of a horrific massacre of civilians demonstrating for democracy by the Chinese military in 1989. And the winner is John Levenick of Champlin, Minnesota. You can keep up with the latest scuttlebutt puzzles, trivia, and political yakking at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. It's 1996, and Bob Dole had a problem. He was a successful leader of the Senate Republicans, managing coalitions and egos and different ideologies, but at the same time, he also wanted to run for president, which he had tried twice before. But there was a sense that the GOP House, led by Speaker Newt Gingrich, had overreached. Their agenda was seen as too far to the right. Republican polling numbers, and Gingrich's particularly, were falling. Dole was on the way to winning his party's presidential nomination, but few thought he could run while staying as majority leader, not when Clinton and the Democrats were effectively linking him with a controversial House Speaker. Dole Gingrich had become one word to the Democrats. Still, no one expected Dole to quit the Senate completely. The Senate he had loved and cherished. It was on This Week in 1996, on June 11th, that Dole gave an emotional farewell to the place he had called home for nearly three decades.
And as all of us go back, we're leaving this year, thinking about leaving a couple of years, whatever, you think about the people who sent you here and the people who tried not to send you here. But once you're here, you forget about those. And they're all your constituents. Whether Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, And four times my friends in Kansas, Republicans and Democrats and Independents, I believe, gave me their votes in the House of Representatives. And five times they've given me their votes for the United States Senate. And I think to all of us, such trust is perhaps the greatest gift that can come to any citizen in our democracy.
Sitting right next to Dole that day, as she did for so many years, was his longtime chief of staff, Sheila Burke. Sheila, thanks so much for being on The Political Junkie.
You're very welcome. It's a great pleasure for me to do so.
If you watch Dole's farewell speech, and I did that, I did this week, people can see you laughing and brushing a tear from your eye at the same time. That was the kind of speech it was, and I think that was the kind of man Bob Dole was and is.
There's no question. It was a bittersweet moment. I know an enormously difficult decision for him, and it was an enormously difficult transition for all of us who had had the privilege of working for him for so many years as I did. We were at a point in history where we knew we were seeing the departure from the Senate of one of its great leaders. It was a decision he came to, I think, after great thought. But I think we all viewed it as a tremendous loss for the institution. And I believe that was true by both Democrats and Republicans.
Do you agree with my assessment that he basically had to leave the Senate, or at least had to leave as majority leader, given the feeling about Congress and how it affected his race against President Clinton?
Well, you know, I think there were a host of reasons that that the senator made the decision. Certainly, the conflict of time, as we all know, certainly then, but even more so today, running for president is, in fact, a full-time job, as is being the majority leader of the United States Senate. And I think he was torn. He, at his heart, was a legislator. I think he instinctively got deeply involved in the subject matter at hand and always wanted to be in the middle of trying to drive consensus. And that is a difficult thing to do when you are on the road. It also gave the opportunity to the Democrats to position or attempt to position him on difficult issues because he was, in fact, his party spokesperson. And so I think there was no question that it was a question of where his loyalties would be and where his time was needed. And I believe the campaign convinced him, and I think he came to the conclusion that you couldn't do both jobs well.
Tell us what the Senate meant to Bob Dole and what Bob Dole meant to the Senate.
Gosh, I mean, I think his own words that we just heard gave you a sense of the importance he placed on the institution and on his responsibilities representing the state of Kansas, which he loves deeply. As you probably know, he's in the midst of touring all 109 counties in Kansas as we speak, as he approaches his 91st birthday. I think to say farewell because of the commitment and support they gave him, but also I think the acknowledgement of what he did for Kansas. I think the institution of the Senate is one built on relationships. It's one built on the ability of individuals to build and drive the consensus. And I think he was a master at that. I think people viewed him on both sides of the aisle as being unbelievably skilled, but it was an enormously important place for him and one that he holds with deep respect.
He was not ashamed to talk about compromise. He was not ashamed about getting things done, as you say. But there were a lot of recent examples, Eric Cantor's defeat among them, that compromise has suddenly become a dirty word on Capitol Hill.
I think that's right, and I think he views that with great sadness. I mean, if you look at that speech that day, the instances that he mentioned where, in fact, they were able to come together, obviously one of the most well-known is his ability with Senator Pat Moynihan, another extraordinary leader in the Senate, to drive consensus on saving Social Security. That is one of many. Food stamps with George McGovern, the development of the hospice benefit. I mean, there's a long list of opportunities that presented themselves where he drove or participated in a real attempt to try and drive consensus. I think he saw his job as being a legislator. He was certainly partisan. There is no question about his having been a real Republican. But I think he saw the importance for both parties to essentially put the country first.
You mentioned that he's a partisan. There's always been harsh descriptions of Dole as a strong partisan, a hatchet man, we heard after the 76 campaign. He was angry. You've known him for decades. Who was Bob Dole?
I think Bob Dole is a patriot. I think he is someone who throughout his life, whether it was in public service, whether it was in his service in the military, whether it was being, an attorney in Kansas, I think he is someone who at the end of the day is a patriot. I think he puts his country first. There is no question that he is a party man as well. And, and he would talk about building consensus doesn't mean that you don't hold dear the politics of your own party and the views of your own party, but it also doesn't prevent you from trying to reach an agreement when there's an important issue at hand. So I view him as someone who put country first.
Sheila Burke is the former chief of staff to Senator Bob Dole. She's currently a senior policy advisor at Baker Donelson and a research professor at Georgetown University's Public Policy Institute. Sheila Burke, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. And join me in wishing an early happy birthday to Bob. He'll turn 91 next month.
Thanks so much. We sure will. Walt Ryker was Dole's press secretary from 1981 to 1993. He was with Dole during his chairmanship of the Senate Finance Committee, when he was Senate Majority Leader, when he was Minority Leader, and during his 1988 presidential campaign. Walt Ryker, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be on with America's most knowledgeable political junkie, Ken Rudin.
Oh, God, could you keep saying that over and over again, please? When I hear Bob Dole's voice, I hear Kansas and I hear the Senate. It was hard to tell the two Bob Doles apart.
It's been a great ride. Few bumps along the way. I've learned a lot from people in this room. I've even gone to Senator Byrd when I was the majority leader to ask his advice on how to defeat him on an issue. And if you know Robert Byrd as I do, he gave me the answer. But it wasn't easy.
Brings it all back, and really, to be honest with you, I've thought about this in light of all the politics that's gone on since, and I would say the day that Dole walked out of the Senate it literally has never been the same. It doesn't operate the same. It doesn't have the same kind of leadership. And frankly, what I see on both sides of the aisle, there's no stature, credibility, or respect for the Senate that Dole engendered and lived, every day on the floor of the Senate. He's tremendously missed because he was a true leader. The rules of the game have changed in the Senate, and I think people should really pay attention to that, because when Bob Dole was there and you had majority leaders, George Mitchell, Democrat, majority leader Robert Byrd, Democrat, it was hardball politics. It was partisan to the core. I mean, that's what politics is all about. Nobody goes to the Senate to be neutral. But at the same time, there were rules of the game in the Senate that everybody understood, like a game of chess. There weren't any moves that were not in the rule book, and you had to work in that kind of arcane system. But it all worked because everybody was kind of a master of the rules. They knew how to get things done within that rule. But what you see now is, at least what I see, is there are no rules. They've been left behind. When Dole was there with Byrd, they worked together. When Dole was there with Mitchell, they worked together. There were some tremendous partisan battles. I mean, epic. At the end of the day, there was always a result.
What's your fondest memory of Bob Dole?
I spent 13 years with Bob Dole, literally 24/7, spent more time with him than probably my own father. I tell you what, two things. One, I never stopped looking at him as a war hero. He suffered grievous injuries in Italy and in World War II, left for dead on the battlefield. And to see how he overcame his own disability, couldn't use his right arm, the stamina that he had, the way he taught himself to write left-handed. I mean, he was an everyday inspiration to me. And then secondly, literally, Bob Dole is the funniest man I've ever been around. One-liners and quick wit, you'd see something and it'd fire off some rapid thing, and it was like Johnny Carson. I mean, he was a truly gifted comedian. Yes, it had a sharp edge to it. If you were a staff member, sometimes it was a little too sharp, but it was the big leagues. I worked in the big leagues for 13 years with a major, major political figure. I mean, a Hall of Famer, in my view, of tremendous stature, and the kind of person we just don't see these days, to tell you the truth.
Walt Ricker was a former press secretary to Bob Dole. After leaving Capitol Hill, he spent 17 years at McDonald's, not in line for a burger, but as the vice president of global media relations. Walt, it's great to talk to you again, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ken. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Coming up next on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, Eric Cantor's loss isn't just a big deal for leadership in the House. We'll talk about what Dave Brett's win means for Tea Party challengers. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. One final word about the primaries. The story we were focusing on Tuesday, or at least the one we thought we were focusing on, was the fate of South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. He's a longtime Tea Party target, and we were waiting to see if he'd pass the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. Now, the week before, the Tea Party threw Thad Cochran of Mississippi into a runoff, one where the odds of him winning a seventh term now look pretty bleak. And then who knew that the story of the day, or the story of the week, or the story of the year, would be about Eric Cantor getting upset in Virginia. So I thought we'd close this week's show with a conversation with Kevin Broughton, the spokesman for the Tea Party Patriot Citizens Fund. Kevin, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Great to be back with you, Ken. And I guess for a political junkie, you might have come close to an OD last night, huh?
Oh, my God. Tuesday was really something. And we'll get to that in a second. And we never OD. The political junkies never OD because then, you know, then what's the point? Anyway, there are three different stories here, and let's do one at a time. When we had you on the show a couple of months ago, you were talking about Mississippi and Thad Cochran was targeted, trailed on two Tuesdays ago, and he's trailing in the polls going into the runoff on the 24th. Were you confident this was going to happen?
Ken, honestly, about 2 weeks, with about 10 days to go before the June 3rd primary in Mississippi, I was convinced that McDaniel was going to win it outright. So, no, I didn't expect a runoff. I expected a clean McDaniel victory. But I think to the national media and punditry, the results of June 3rd were no less stunning.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who thought that the shenanigans about the people who tried to go into the hospital and take photographs of Mrs. Cochran and that could have the possibility of a backlash against the McDaniel, even though he wasn't personally involved.
Right. And, you know, we had polls in the field just before the story broke. And then we had another poll in the field about a week after. So the story had time to ruminate a little bit. And what we found was it didn't really move the undecideds one way or another. It tended to fortify both McDaniel's support and Cochran's base of support. But we saw that distraction was really just that, a distraction.
Given the fact that the state chair of Mississippi, Joe Nosef, and Haley Barbour and Haley Barbour's organization all supported Cochran, what happened to the Republican machine, the vaunted Republican machine in Mississippi?
That's a really good question. And I think, you know, we'll get to Lindsey Graham in a second. I think Lindsey Graham, once 2010 happened, Lindsey Graham knew that he would have a fight on his hands in 4 years. I don't think the Mississippi establishment got that message. I think they were caught flat-footed. They didn't think this race was ever going to be close. In the last 10 days, they figured out that it was way too close for comfort. But really, and as we look forward to this runoff in just a couple of weeks, and I don't have to tell a political junkie this, but runoffs are determined by turnout and energy and enthusiasm. And the McDaniel campaign had that in spades. I mean, his supporters were energized. And I promise you, Ken, after Tuesday's results in Virginia, they probably smell a little more blood in the water now.
Does the McDaniel do anything different in the days leading up to the 24th?
I don't think so. What got him to this point was his ground game, and I think his campaign is going to continue to focus on that. I know the Tea Party Patriot Citizens Fund will all decamp to Mississippi here in about the next 2 or 3 days, and we're going to be working the ground game just like we were for the last 10 days before the June 3rd primary.
Now, you mentioned Lindsey Graham, and apparently he, like Mitch McConnell, like John Boehner, like other potential Tea Party targets, looked at the results of what happened in 2010, 2012, and prepared for it. What happened to Eric Cantor? Because this is days later, but I'm still stunned from it.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a close cousin to what happened to Thad Cochran. He lost touch with his district. You know, I've spent the last 24 hours or so really kind of poring over the analysis and sort of a common thread in the people who are purportedly in a position to know is that Cantor became more concerned with keeping the House leadership and the House conference in line and raising money for the party. And really kind of forgot about the people who had sent him to Washington in 2000.
Now, we keep talking, and you've heard this theme all year long, the establishment Republicans versus the Tea Party Republicans. On Tuesday night, what particularly struck me is that there were a lot of conservatives, like your group and other Tea Party organizations, were angrily denounced by Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter and others for failing to help David Bratt in his win over Eric Cantor. Did your group not see this as a winnable race? Was Eric Cantor did you decide that Eric Cantor was not somebody who needed to be targeted?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, you know. And I heard the comments that Ms. Ingraham made. I'll tell you this: nobody saw this coming, Ken. Nobody did. And kudos to Laura Ingraham and Mark Levin. Hindsight is 20/20, obviously. But that's just not a race that anybody really could foresee turning out the way it did. We're thrilled that there's going to be a change in the House Republican leadership, and we're thrilled that a guy who espouses free market principles like David Bratt is in office. But you know, it's hindsight is 20/20.
What does Bratt's win say about the rest of the primary season? Is it that nobody is safe anymore? And what about Lamar Alexander, Pat Roberts, other senators who face Tea Party opposition in the primaries?
Well, I don't know that it really says anything that you can project onto the rest of the primary electorate around the country, other than maybe this was, I think, not necessarily Tea Party versus establishment, but this was populism versus elitism. I really tend to believe that. If you look at that, it's a safe Republican district. There were not just a whole lot of votes cast, but I think this is maybe the beginning of a wave that you may not see a bunch of Republican incumbents knocked off between now and the end of primary season, maybe one or two more. But I think this still could be a portent of a wave election, sort of like 2010.
When I heard David Bratt on Tuesday night, he was talking about what Eric Cantor did wrong and what the Republican leadership in Congress did wrong. They focused more on Wall Street than Main Street. He sounded a lot like Elizabeth Warren.
I've heard that comparison more than once.
I didn't make it up. I didn't make that up.
I think maybe folks were just channeling Ken Rudin.
Okay.
I think that kind of goes back to my last point. This really isn't necessarily partisan. It's not necessarily Tea Party versus establishment. It's, you know, there are blue collar voters on both sides of the aisle. I think it will inure to the benefit more of Republicans and insurgent candidates between now and November than it will the Democrat Party.
Kevin Broughton is a spokesman for the Tea Party Patriot Citizens Fund. Kevin, thanks so much for being on the show.
Enjoyed it, Ken. Let's talk again soon.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttle button puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash, never kidding about the cash, to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And you can find The Political Junkie on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And also, if you have a question you need answered, a comment requiring a response, or if you're just lonely and need someone to talk to, call our Google voicemail inbox at 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-536-9646. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Graywinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.